they were saying when they think you cannot hear. If you understood what they do, if for you it was so clear. If you knew they shut down the factory in an economic ruse. If you could kiss the cheek of the child in the sweatshop that made your shoes. Every time we went to war to fight our evil foes, they told you we were really fighting for the good of CEOs. If you could feel the hunger of the many, see the riches of the few. If they told it like it is, what if you knew?
You're listening to Clearing the Fog, Speaking Truth to Expose the Forces of Greed with Margaret Flowers. Clearing the Fog is a project of PopularResistance.org. You can subscribe to it on Apple, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and Google Play. You can also find Clearing the Fog at PopularResistance.org, and while you're there, you can subscribe to the free Daily Digest. Each morning, you'll receive an email that has summaries of the articles posted the day before. This is a great way to keep up with movement news and analysis. So this week, I interviewed Mike Preisner, who is an Iraq War veteran and is the new executive director of the Center on Conscience and War, has done a lot of organizing with veterans over the years, and is now assisting military members who are interested in pursuing conscientious objector status. I also included in this program a previous interview I did with James Branham. James is with the Military Law Task Force of the National Lawyers Guild, and I spoke to him in June of 2025, primarily about the deployment of the military and ICE to cities around the country, beginning with Los Angeles. And then we talked about the rights of members of the military. And I think this is an important complement to Mike's information, because James talks about what military members' legal rights are, their right to refuse illegal orders, and things they should consider before doing that. And he also offers resources for military members. I don't want to delay getting to these interviews, so we'll begin with James Branham. James is a solo practice attorney who practices primarily in defending military service members in courts martial, administrative boards, and related matters. He's a past co-chair of the National Lawyers Guild Military Law Task Force and currently serves as a volunteer for the MLTF. James, thank you so much for taking time to speak with me today.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Today we're going to talk about kind of the ICE raids that are happening across the country and the invocation of bringing in the National Guard and the military. But before we get to that, can you tell the listeners about the National Lawyers Guild Military Law Task Force?
Sure. The Military Law Task Force is a part of the broader National Lawyers Guild, but we're an organization of lawyers and legal workers and barracks lawyers, which is barracks lawyers are members of the military who help other service members with administrative problems they have. We're a broad-based organization of those groups, and our focus is helping and equipping those who help service members with the resources they need to effectively do them. But we also are doing this from a unique perspective. And that's where the NLG part comes in. The National Lawyers Guild is an organization of legal activists that is focused on an anti-imperial, anti-capitalist approach to the law. And so we take that analysis with us as the MLTF, but we do so in a nuanced, thoughtful way, seeking to amplify the rights of service members. And especially, we focus a great deal of our efforts on helping service members to find their own voices and to exercise their free speech rights within the law. We publish a quarterly journal that's aimed at practitioners. We also do continuing legal education trainings. And we also partner with a lot of organizations, including Veterans for Peace, About Face Veterans Against the War, the GI Rights Hotline, and many others in working on these issues.
Yeah, it's fantastic work and so necessary. So let's talk a little bit about what's going on. I'd like to start with your thoughts on what's happening across the country right now with the ICE raids that are taking place.
We are in a very different territory than we've been in recent years. U.S. history, of course, is full of times of government oppression of people. That part is not unique. What is unique, at least in the modern era, is the attempt of the current administration to involve military forces in civilian matters here in this country, doing things like deployments of National Guard, sending in Marines into U.S. cities. This is something that hasn't happened in some time, and it really is deeply frightening. It's also deeply frightening to me because of the legal uncertainty of it. One of the challenging things, we right now have a federal district court in California which has said that this kind of deployment is unlawful. Now we have the circuit court that has put that on hold. This level of uncertainty is deeply distressing. And for me, from a constitutional standpoint, the balance of powers we have here between the three branches of government, but also in our federal system, the balance between state and the federal government is really at a very fragile situation. And we literally, for members of the National Guard, for in states like California and Texas, they're in situations where that they may be given conflicting orders at some point between what their governor might say, what the president might say. This is not a good situation.
I was just watching a clip actually before our interview of a sheriff from Brevard County, Florida, who was outlining the consequences for people who would try to obstruct ICE from taking people. And he literally said, you know, if you interfere, then we'll notify your family where to pick up your remains. It feels like we're in very like extra legal territory right now and not much consideration for the law. Would you agree?
Absolutely. And I think the other problem, though, is, I mean, the extra legal stuff is terrifying. But what's also terrifying is what is currently in the law. If you look at federal law with regards to obstruction of federal agents, the penalties are extremely high. Multiple years in prison are potential consequences. And so we are in a very difficult situation right now in this country where ordinary people are standing up for their neighbors, saying, no, we do not want our neighbors to be kidnapped off the streets and shipped to who knows where. The problem is that if it's deemed as being obstructing what is going on, there is a very serious risk of criminal prosecution, and again, the potential risk of multiple years in prison as a possible punishment. I'm not saying that to be alarmist. I'm saying that's the reality. For civilian activists, it has some deeply troubling questions. For people in the military, it raises a whole other set of questions.
Could you maybe speak to this about the difference in training and weapons between kind of local law enforcement and bringing in military members?
Yeah, dramatically different. Members of the military, unless you've been trained in military as a mil in military police or a military occupational specialty, you're not being trained in crowd control. You're not being trained in civil rights. You're not being trained on what are the boundary lines for civ and in law enforcement. We know that civilian law enforcement, let's be frank, is not terribly well trained in many places, that
Right.
there's major problems. We're very well aware of the issues of police brutality. And so I don't want to, by saying that law enforcement is better equipped, I'm not saying that law enforcement has their act together. I don't believe they do in many cases. What I am saying is that minimal level of training is largely non-existent in the military for the average person being sent on these deployments. And so that inadequate, not enough training that should be happening, that is non-existent in the military context. And one of the problems is frankly, let's be frank, how the military is trained is often to take advantage of instability in an environment that they're in. For instance, if U.S. troops are deployed in a foreign location in a war context, often they are looking for ways to further destabilize a situation to gain the upper hand. That's obviously not an appropriate tactic in
Right.
when dealing with civilian people in the United States.
So let's turn to the military folks who may be deployed now or in the future into communities. What rights do they have if they feel like they're being ordered to do something that's against the Constitution or against the law?
So there's some challenging issues related to this. I'm going to try to unpack this the best I can. I will mention, of course, as a lawyer, I can't tell someone to break the law. I can discuss the ethical, moral, and legal consequences of breaking the law, but I can't tell someone to break the law as a lawyer. So I'm just want to say that if whoever's listening in, I want to
Right.
be really clear on that point.
Right.
So some of the issues that are at stake here is that I would first begin by saying that under military law, there is a protection that exists for there's legal protection for an unlawful order, that a service member cannot be punished for disobeying an unlawful order. And that is found in the, how we get there for that is a couple of provisions. One is the Uniform Code of Military Justice, Article 92, states that anyone who's subject to the UCMJ who fails to obey a lawful general order or regulation can be punished. Or also having knowledge of any other lawful order issued by a member of the armed forces, which is duty to obey, fails to obey the order, or derelict in the performance of his duty, shall be punished as the court martial may direct. So, in other words, if you've been given a lawful order, you must follow it, is what the military says. The
Right.
question is, what's left here, not explained, is that what is a lawful order? It's not there in Article 92. Where it is found is in a document called the Manual for Courts Martial. This is a large 800-page plus document. It's a PDF. By the way, just if anyone's curious, jsc.defense.gov. If you go there, go to current, I believe it's under current publications, you can find a link to it. It's good reading. But in that, in the Manual for Courts Martial, it of course contains the text of the UCMJ. It includes the military rules of evidence, some other things, but it also includes the rules for court martial. And in that, there's also commentary, which helps military judges and other people to interpret the UCMJ. And so the key part there is it says lawfulness. A general order or regulation is lawful unless it is contrary to the Constitution, the laws of the United States, or lawful superior orders, or for some other reason is beyond the authority of the official issuing it. See the discussion of lawfulness below. The problem is when you get into that discussion of lawfulness, here's the real problem, is that it says inference of lawfulness. An order requiring the performance of a military duty or act may be inferred to be lawful, and it is disobeyed at the peril of the subordinate. The inference does not apply to a patently illegal order, such as one that directs the commission of a crime. Then it says determination of lawfulness. The lawfulness of an order is a question of law to be determined by the military judge. What that means practically is unless it is a patently illegal order, such as your commander says, I want you to kill this civilian without cause right now, that would be patently illegal. There would be no question that you cannot do that. But what about an order that's not quite of that nature, but is clearly illegal? Unfortunately, the only person who can decisively say that the order is illegal is a military judge. And the problem is, military judges, by the unique nature of the UC of how the military system of justice works, military judges, they are in power, you might say, when their court is convened into existence. So the court is not in existence when it's, I don't know how to explain this except to
Right, it's
say that
just as
there's no
needed.
way to get an advisory opinion.
Right. So it's an as needed basis, kind of.
Yes. And so what it means practically is that a service member who's facing this question, there's no one to go to for an advisory opinion. And in state governments, if a state official in my state says, hey, I don't know if this law or this regulation is lawful or not, they can ask the attorney general for a formal opinion and they can rely upon that order until a judge shoots down the attorney general's opinion. There's nothing that functions like that in the military, which means service members being given orders to say deploy to Los Angeles have to determine for themselves whether something is constitutional or not, whether it's lawful or not. And then, if they act upon that and they actually disobey the order, they're taking the gamble of whether the military judge would see it their way or not. They're also taking the gamble, though, they won't be punished in some way outside of court. And here's the problem. Most of the time, when someone is punished for something in the military, it doesn't go to a court martial. It's actually dealt with through administrative processes, through non-judicial punishment, or through an administrative separation. So someone could say he's been in 18 years, about ready to retirement. If they in a situation like this, they don't have to be prosecuted. They could just be kicked out early prior to retirement, losing the retirement. And there'd be very few ways to effectively address that, to stop it from happening, because again, the only person who can determine if an order is lawful is the military judge. And
Wow.
so because of that, one of the things I would recommend to service members facing these questions is, first of all, if at all possible, try to find a way to avoid the showdown. What I mean by that is having a conversation with the commander, exercising what's usually called a command open door policy, to make a meeting with the commander to say, look, commander, I don't want to put you in a bad spot. I don't want to be disrespectful in any way. But I this this the this deployment I've heard we're going to be sent on soon, I can't do it. It violates my conscience. I have serious legal questions about it. Please, please keep me off this deployment. And my belief is, in many cases, commanders are going to say yes to that to that request, because commanders, they don't want someone on the deployment who doesn't want to be there. So I would begin by saying that, if at all possible, to try to avoid the showdown. But if that is not possible at that point, then a service member who's facing those questions does have some soul searching to do, because of potentially, if they lose, they could be looking at jail time. They could be looking at other negative consequences. I will say the good news is there are people there that are ready to support them if it comes down to that. Of course, in the military, every service member is entitled to the public defenders, the defense JAG. One good thing about the military is you don't have to prove you're poor to get a public defender. You get one if you're always entitled to one. But you can also hire civilian counsel, and that's where my organization, the Military Law Task Force, we try to help connect service members with legal counsel, outside legal counsel. And there are cases, and I think a case like this are the ones that where outside legal counsel can be very helpful, because outside legal counsel, we can be more aggressive in ways than defense JAG may be willing to. We're, for instance, if we have to talk to the press to better our client's position, we can do so, following the rules, of course, of the court and all of that, and legal ethics, but we can talk to the press. Defense JAG are extremely reticent to ever do that, for instance. There's other things that we can do. So I would strongly urge anyone who's facing these kinds of orders, who's actually in the place of considering disobeying orders, to talk to legal counsel, and especially reach out to civilian counsel to make sure that you've done everything possible to put yourself in the best position possible. Also, it's imperative that if you have to disobey an order for the because it's unconstitutional, because it's unlawful, you need to do so in as respectful a way as possible, because you don't want to open up a door for them to prosecute you, and maybe you're acquitted for disobeying for disobeying a lawful order because the order was unlawful, but they could still hit you for disrespect of either anyone in your command chain, including the president, which means you can't go into the territory of disrespect. It's one thing to say, I disagree with the president. It's another thing to use abusive language when discussing the president. You and I, as civilians, we can do that. Members of the military can be punished for that. And so there are some really important cautions there. On the other hand, what I want service members to know is that if you're facing these choices, there are resources out there. You can get help. I'd also mention along the way, there's a few other organizations that can be very helpful. The GI Rights Hotline in particular, is an important organization. Their number, by the way, is 1-877 447-4487. The website is girightshotline.org. They're a free organization. They don't charge for their services, but a group, a nationwide network of counselors who take the calls to assist service members in exercising their rights. I'll also mention, for issues of conscience in particular, for someone who, through this experience, may be questioning their views about war itself, about military service, who have broader questions beyond just this immediate situation, I would encourage them to contact either the Center on Conscience and War or Quaker House in Fayetteville, North Carolina. Those are two organizations that work specifically with conscientious objectors. That is, people who have had a change of heart since they've enlisted, who now see things differently and can no longer serve in the military for reasons of conscience. For those folks, I really encourage them to get in touch with CCW or Quaker House. They can be very helpful.
Right. Well, those are great resources. Thank you so much for that. Have you seen any change this year in the number of people from the military reaching out to the MLTF?
Yes, the MLTF has seen an uptick in calls for sure. I know the GI Rights Hotline in particular, which is, by the way, the MLTF, we are a part of the GI Rights Network, so it's a broader network. But I
Okay.
know that network, I know that there is a story just came out yesterday in a newspaper in Raleigh, Durham, North Carolina, that was quoted some folks from the hotline that said that they were receiving between 200 and 300 calls a week. Now, sometimes they're getting that many calls a day.
Wow.
It is a really a huge bump in the volume of calls. So yeah, there's a lot of people concerned. I will
Right.
say for myself, a lot of people calling me are in, they are concerned, they have not been given the orders yet to deploy. They are concerned about what they will do if it comes to that. So I'm meeting with a lot of people. just advising them to what are their rights through this process, and also helping them to just navigate this situation, and when possible to again avoid the showdown. And again, there's a place for the showdown, and particularly for folks who can risk that, who can risk having their life put on hold potentially for a good while, for potential prosecution, for potential even prison time. I do think there's great value in people who are willing to take those risks. It's not for everybody, and for members of the military, I want to be clear, there's lots of ways to push back against what you don't believe in. One, of course, is to disobey an unlawful order. Other ways are to engage in free speech actions, to use your power to speak out. And contrary to popular opinion, members of the military do not surrender their First Amendment rights when they enlist. There are some specific restrictions on them, but those restrictions are still tempered by the Constitution. There are some good resources out there on what some of these boundary lines are. The
Go ahead.
regulation that's most important is D Department of Defense Instruction 1325.06. It lays out the boundary lines of what service members can and can't do as it relates to free speech actions. And basically, the idea here is the First Amendment does protect service members' right to speak, but there are some limitations that are based upon the military clause specific provisions of the Constitution. So things that service members can do, they can participate in protest. If they are off duty, off post, out of uniform, they are not, and they are not, do they need, we're really critical to not be in uniform, including any piece of the uniform. Don't wear even part of the uniform at a protest. And they also can't be in a place where violence is likely to occur. Now, one problem is, what about the circumstance where the police are the ones to initiate violence? I would argue that's one of the problems with this regulation constitutionally. I don't think it's right to stop a service member from participating in a protest because the police are the ones to initiate violence. But nevertheless, my advice to a service member is, if there's any chance of violence, then that's a protest that potentially they should not participate in. Beyond that, service members, there are some restrictions on electoral politics type of stuff. But largely, they are able to participate in a lot of free speech actions. They are able to talk to the press. They do need to make it clear that they're speaking on their own behalf, not on the military's behalf. They can't use disrespectful language about the commander in chief. They can't encourage disloyalty by the troops. There's also some limitations. Members of the military are forbidden by law from unionizing or collective bargaining. And in fact, that provision applies to civilians too. It is a federal crime to try to assist military service members to collectively bargain or to unionize in some way. So there are some boundary lines, but outside of those boundary lines, members of the military can speak out. Another big way members of the military can speak out is by writing their members of Congress, the president, because those fall under the category of protected communications. And so those are things that they cannot be punished for having those conversations. And so there's lots of ways that people can speak out. I would also say, informally within the military, speaking to your comrades, speaking to the people you serve with about your concerns, that's legal. You can have those conversations. Again, if there's more specific questions, encourage folks to contact the MLTF or the GI Rights Hotline for more assistance. But overall, what I want folks to know who are in the military is you can use your voice. You do have the power. And frankly, you have a perspective and credibility that those of us on the outside don't have. And so when you speak, people listen. And so it's really important you do speak and that you're supported in that speech.
And it sounds like from what you're saying that they won't be alone, that there are a lot of people out there that have concerns about what's happening. And so sometimes it takes the
Absolutely.
courage of one person to speak up, and you find that there are a lot of other people that are feeling the same way that you are. So yeah, that's great information to have. Any final words for the listeners before we go?
I think one thing, word I would say is, for those of you listening who are not in the military, I think it's very easy sometimes for those of us not in the military to make assumptions about people in the military, to assume that they believe X, they believe Y. I would encourage you to not go into your conversations with people in the military with those stereotypes. Instead, engage them, have thoughtful conversations, and also be ready to show support and kindness to them when they're facing these moral challenges. The more that we can hear from veterans and service members about their experiences, the better. So one thing I'm really hoping more and more we can hear from military voices And I think in doing so, we as a society are going to be a lot stronger. One of the things I think as terrible as this situation is with these deployments to Los Angeles, what has also happened is we now have several thousand people, members of the military, who have now have a whole different experience. We need to hear from them. We need to hear from them about what it was like to be walking the streets of an American city, fully armed, in battle gear. What was that like? What did that do to you? And what was that interchange, that exchange, that encountering members of the public? What was that like? We need to hear from folks who were asked to do this, because I think if we do that, we're going to be asking a lot more tough questions about why in the world did Trump send these people and put them in this position? It's particularly also add to the California National Guard. You look at the high percentage of Latinx people in the National Guard. The fact that the fascist administration sent Latinx people into these situations is just abominable. And so we need to hear from them.
Right. Yeah, very important advice. Well, James, I want to thank you so much for the critical work that you're doing and for taking time to speak with me today.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Now we'll take a short musical break and come back with the interview with Mike Prisner.
Oh, you tell me that there's danger to this land you call your own. And you watch them build the war machines right beside your home. And you tell me that you're ready to go marching to the war. Oh, I know you're set for fighting, but what are you fighting for? Before you pack your rifle and sail across the sea, just think upon the southern part of land that you call free. Oh, there's many kinds of slavery, and we've found many more. Yes, I know you're set for fighting, but what are you fighting for? Turn on your TV, turn it on so loud, and watch the fool a smiling there and tell me that you're proud. And listen to your radio, the noise it starts to pour. Oh, I know you're set for fighting.
You're listening to
but what are
Clearing
you
the
fighting
Fog,
for?
speaking truth to expose the forces of greed with Margaret Flowers. Now I turn to my guest, Mike Prisner. Mike is a veteran of the Iraq War and a well-known anti-war organizer who has worked for a long time with other veterans. And currently, Mike serves as the executive director for the Center for Conscience and War. Mike, thank you so much for taking time to speak with me today.
Thanks for having me, Margaret.
So, we're going to talk about the conflict in West Asia and how members of the military are responding to that. But before we get to that, could you tell the listeners about the Center for Conscience and War, what it is and what it does?
Well, the Center on Conscience and War has been around for over 85 years. It really started in response to how poorly conscientious objectors were treated in the draft during World War I, and since then has been the seminal conscientious objection organization in the United States. And they have defended the rights of conscientious objectors in every war since they founded. But, that kind of changed in the Vietnam era, because prior to Vietnam, this was strictly a religious beliefs that were respected as for conscientious objectors. But this was challenged in the courts by the conscientious objection movement in the late 1960s, and in 1970 there was a landmark court ruling that found that non-religious moral beliefs qualify as conscientious objection. And so that changed the game in a lot of ways. And so right now the clients that we have, CCW gives free professional counseling to those in the military who are seeking conscientious objection. And we help people with other things too, but that's our specialty. And right now most people, I would say, have non-religious moral beliefs that are filing as conscientious objection. And so it's a very powerful tool, a right that service members have that we find that many don't know about, let alone know that there's services that exist that can help them. And so part of our job is to aid those who contact us and want to file as a CO. But another big part of our job is spreading awareness in the military about the fact that this is an option. And then even people who know that CO is a thing, they assume that they don't qualify for it, because there's a lot of misconceptions about what a CO is and what fits that standard. And so many of the people we've been talking to recently initially thought that they would never qualify as a CO, but once they hear what it really is, realize that they do.
Well, and the organization has, I guess, made an impact because recently you were censored on social media. Can you talk about what happened?
Yeah, I was excited to come into this role as executive director. Really honored to help steward this historic organization into a new phase. And one of my goals was to increase the visibility. And so I actually started this job on like the day that all the soldiers got killed in Kuwait, which was not intended. I knew about a month before that I was going to take the position, but yeah, it coincided with the start of a new big war. And so we really hit the ground running with making sure service members through all platforms we could find knew that we existed and had a hotline and people could call for help if they disagreed with the Iran war and disagreed with deploying. And one of those posts was letting service members know about, and I wouldn't call it a loophole, but there was a change recently over the past couple of years where any service member who's in their first year of service, they're considered entry level. And if they express to their command that they are not adapting to life in the military, they're not adapting to the military, a failure to adapt is an entry level discharge that is available to people in that first year in service. And the number of people in the first year of service is like over 200,000 service members. So it's a good number of people. So we simply posted that that is a way that people get out of the military. It's completely legal. It's within the regulations. And we were banned from Twitter for advocating for illegal activity was the violation we got.
But then were you reinstated? Because I've seen the tweets out there. Are you still
Yeah,
banned?
it was a 12-hour ban, yes.
Yeah, okay, good. Good. So, I understand that the organization has been hearing from many members of the military and their family members. Can you give the listeners an idea of the volume of contacts that you're getting and what folks are saying?
Yeah, well, just since the war started, we've had more than a 1,000% increase in number of CO clients that we've taken on. And this really runs a range of people. There's all branches of military service from active to guard to reserve. We have officers, people who are physicians, people who are fighter jet pilots. We have lower and mid-ranking enlisted personnel. We have infantrymen, we have intelligence personnel. We have people who are low ranking, just started their careers, and we have people as high ranking as major who have had long careers. And this really is like a small sample size, right? Because, like I said, most people don't know that CO is an option, and even less of those people know that we even exist as an organization. I would say CCW is not known to most people in the military, or the fact that we have a number you can call to get help. And so for everyone that's called us, who knows how many more service members are thinking the same things that they're thinking, but just haven't seen something that has our phone number on it, or haven't gotten more information about conscientious objection. And everyone that we do talk to, they all tell us that there's at least a few other people in their unit that oppose the war as well. So I think that opposition to the war from within the military is more widespread than one might imagine. And the things that they're saying, of course, there's probably a variety of different views and why people oppose this war, but I think because we are taking calls from people who are conscientiously objecting to this, the biggest thing we hear is just not wanting to associate with the killing of people abroad, the killing of children and civilians, and the bombings of hospitals and schools. And that's really the number one thing people say they're mortified about having to take part in directly, or just putting on the uniform in the morning is giving them a very conflicted feeling about their lives and who they are and who they want to be. And I would say that most of those people mention the Minab school massacre as like a breaking point for them. And I think there's a misconception that people trying to get out of going to war or out of a deployment are mainly concerned with their own well-being and safety. But I haven't taken any calls from people who are scared to be killed in Iran. They're scared of killing other people in Iran.
Yeah, I understand that. I guess it was one of the naval ships in the area that after the Manab killing, they cut off the access of the people on the ship to social media so they wouldn't be aware of what the US and Israel had done.
Yeah, that's something we heard from a family member actually, when their loved one was able to communicate, that's what they told them when they lost their internet access.
And there have been reports that troops were being prepared for a ground invasion of Iran and people were being moved there. Can you talk a little bit about how folks were responding to that? And
Yeah, I mean,
having to stay longer into the in service.
Right. Well, I mean, there's that 31st Marine Expeditionary Unit that's headed there now. You know, that is a ground invasion force. You know, it's not a guarantee that it will be used to invade the ground, but that's what their job is. And they are, you know, being sent there, you know, ostensibly to use that option if Trump chooses to exercise that option. There's also, you know, more of that. We already know about the ships that have left from that unit. There's more that are leaving soon from that unit as well. And so that initial 5,000 that got all the press, like, you know, there's people following behind them that may be leaving this weekend. You know, and those people too, they were on a training exercise. They had already been out in the field, you know, in the Philippines doing patrols and joint patrols with Japanese forces and things like that. So they were already out in the field. They never got to go home. And so their families found out that they were being redirected from those patrols to the Middle East. You know, they found out by getting like a letter from the commanders. You know, those service members had already been gone for months and months and months and did not get a chance to go home and see their families. So, you know, on that basis alone, I imagine there's a bit of discontent. But, you know, even in that, you know, we've, like I said, we've gotten a large number of calls and new CO clients. We've heard from several people in that unit, in the 31st Marine Expeditionary Unit. So even those that are in the, you know, the frontline combat arms people that people would assume are the most heavily indoctrinated and perhaps excited to go to war. That's probably true for a large number of them, but there are still those among them that are very opposed to what's happening, and some who, you know, are unsure about whether or not they can even do it.
Right. And I wonder if you have much familiarity with what's going on with the USS Gerald Ford, because, you know, we had the story initially that the toilets were clogged and we had, you know, thousands of members of the Navy on that ship and not adequate facilities for them. And then there was the fire in the laundry room that's being investigated as possibly having been set by people on the ship. Are you familiar with that situation?
Yeah, I mean, it's entirely plausible that service members, you know, intentionally clogged the toilets to make them have to go back to port, or that somebody set a fire. I mean, those things are totally plausible. I mean, when I was deployed, we engaged in different acts of sabotage, so we would have to stop doing certain things that we didn't want to do. So, you know, there's precedent for it, and it's definitely, you know, you got a big ship with a lot of people. You got to imagine some of those are disgruntled about being out, and you know, that's an easy way to make yourself go back. So it's entirely possible. It's also entirely possible that, you know, it was hit by an Iranian drone and it's being covered up. That I imagine we would find out at some point in the future. It's also entirely plausible that it's just equipment failure and that the stuff just sucks. The laundry room sucks. The toilet system sucks. I mean, we have this obscene, bloated military budget that just spent on the most ridiculous stuff. It's totally on brand for like the most expensive ship in the world to be kind of not able to operate in a real situation. I mean, it is very kind of classic when you really think about the military industrial complex. You know, you pay for all these weapons and the toilets don't work. You know, that's actually not a surprising scenario either.
I mean, well, you know, those at the top are having they're in luxury accommodations, I'm sure.
Yeah, the guy, the shareholders are doing good.
I saw a report recently that 13 soldiers deserted from the USS George Bush off the coast of Israel and went to northern Cyprus. And I understand that in 18 days since the conflict began on Iran, that 73 people have deserted. Have you heard much
Oh
about
no,
this?
I haven't at all.
That's another way that
That's
folks.
really interesting. You know, I people like that, I mean, I that's the people that we really hope we can reach, because if people are feeling like they're in that situation and they have to do that, it's best for them to talk to legal counsel and advisors that can help them advise them on what they, you know, other options they may have in that situation. But that's, you know, I think that's again just the tip of the iceberg, right? I mean, people who are willing to take such bold action like that, which could get them sent to jail, for every one of those people, there's a lot more who may agree with them, but just aren't ready to take such a bold step like that.
And we're also hearing there are tremendous numbers of members of the military filing complaints because their commanding officers are telling them, speaking in religious terms, as if this conflict is all about bringing the second coming of Christ or something like that. Are you hearing that from the folks that you're talking to or concerns?
Yeah, Yeah, you know, one of those units is the 31st Marine Expeditionary Unit, where there's at least one commander who has used that rhetoric in talking about this. We've heard from other family members who relay that their loved one said that that's the kind of stuff that they're hearing. I did talk to someone yesterday who's in the army, who said that, you know, I think it started out, it became a story because that was like command was putting that stuff out.
Right.
The soldier I talked to yesterday, he said that's just like the chatter now among even like lower enlisted people. Like, so there it's kind of seeped into a sector of the military that is, you know, a religious extremist or MAGA people. And so it's no longer just a thing that's being put out by commanders, but there's some sector of the military that is talking about the war in those types of terms. And so, you know, it reminds me of like the racist propaganda put out in the beginning of the Iraq War. Like it starts at the top and then it just trickles its way down to the lower enlisted.
So the lower enlisted are parroting the same racism that they're hearing from their superiors. Yeah, very interesting. Well, speaking of the MAGA movement, we have the just recently the resignation of Joe Kent, who was also a member of the military, and his wife died in Syria. What are your thoughts on that resignation and what that says about this particular conflict and the state of the Pentagon and the military?
Well, it's definitely a big blow to the Trump administration because, you know, there's probably no more credible person in that world to resign in protest of something. I mean, of all people in the Trump administration, you know, most of them are freaks of different varieties. And this guy just, you know, he comes off to the mainstream as and people in the military, of course, as just a very credible, trustworthy guy. You know, the fact also that he was, you know, the close friend and appointee of Tulsi Gabbard as head of the DNI, you know, whose whole brand is preventing a war in Iran, preventing another disastrous, pointless regime change war in the Middle East. And for him to be the one to resign instead of her, that also is I think a big blow to their credibility. But I think for people in the military, it is an important thing that has happened because really when you look at what Joe Kent did, you know, he gave up, you know, his job and the career that he had and the position of power that he had. You know, he sacrificed that because he had a crisis of conscience. He could not, in good conscience, continue to serve while something was happening that he believed was wrong. And so that shows people in the military that, you know, if Joe Kent is willing to do it, why shouldn't you be willing to do it also? You know, I
Right.
did talk to someone yesterday who's putting in a CO packet very soon. And for them, that specifically was like the moment of crystallization for them. It was like, it's like, I already opposed this war, but I was just going along with it. The example that Joe Kent sent of just, you know, I'm not, I can't be a part of this. It made this person and probably many others think, well, by me just going along with it, I'm not really living my beliefs when he was living his beliefs. And so I think it's been an important development just for setting an example for service members.
Yeah. I remember when, when the back, I guess, starting in October of 23, when there was Operation Al-Aqsa Flood, and then the response from the Israeli occupying forces, the escalation of the genocide against Palestinians, and then in June of last year, the attack on Iran that was totally uncalled for back then. I remember talking to Colonel Ann Wright, who I know you know, and she retired, quit over the Iraq War. And I said, oh, some folks are starting to resign over this situation. And she said, we should see a lot more resignations. Like she wasn't impressed that one person was resigning. She really felt like there ought to be a lot more. Do you have inklings of whether we'll see more people defecting from this?
Yeah, well, you know, Anne was like a very unique person, right? I mean, someone at that grade of officer resigning in protest, you know, is extremely rare. And unfortunately, in the military, when you get to that level of leadership, like you kind of want a war to happen because when you get your war command, you know, you put another star on, you put more medals on, you know, it's very good for your careers. And so, you know, I remember really clearly when the Iraq War was starting, like the officers from lieutenant colonel up, you know, and even younger ones, they were very pumped to have their opportunity to have their battlefield commands. And so I don't have a lot of hope for that echelon of the military. I mean, look, these are the people that just took us through how many years of Iraq and Afghanistan where they were just like lying, like where they come into a command, they are completely aware that it's just Afghanistan alone, right? For how many years, 10 or more years, a rotating number of generals who come in and realize, oh, this war is a completely lost war. It is completely impossible to win. It's completely pointless what we're doing here. Let's just keep lying about it and saying that we're making progress. And then in 2 years, my command will be over and someone else will take over and I'll pin another star and I'll get a bunch of awards. I mean, that's the way that they operate. So we can't have any hope or trust in any of them to do the right thing because, you know, they have demonstrated that they don't actually really care. What I have hope in is the people, the lower ranks, the lower enlisted, non-commissioned officers and young officers who are the ones that I think are really thinking deeply about this. They're much less invested in being a military person as their entire identity and career. And so those are the people that we should be looking to and having hope in. And yeah, what we haven't seen, which I expect we would see outside, you know, instead of high-ranking officers resigning, you know, we haven't seen any active duty people publicly speaking out or publicly refusing to go yet. That I would, if this war continues to drag on, especially if there's boots on the ground, I think that is something we would expect to see.
And I think back to Vietnam when there was a lot of resistance within the military, fragging officers, and you talked about, sabotage as something that folks engaged in when you were in the military. How kind of widespread is the knowledge of, those kinds of tactics? Do you think that we'll be seeing some of those types of
I
things?
don't think it is really widespread. The knowledge of that history, in fact, even in the left, I feel like it's a history that's not super well known. The thing is, you know, that Vietnam is really like the exciting story of GI rebellion against an imperialist war. But, you know, as successful as that was during the Vietnam War, you know, and the Pentagon estimated, you know, by 1971 that like half of the armed forces had defected to the anti-war movement and were like in a state of mutiny. That took many years to develop. And in the first several years of the Vietnam War, it was almost non-existent and it was strictly punished. The military completely had the upper hand. There was very, very isolated incidents of resistance from service members. Right now, this war is barely getting started, and there's already a high level of opposition and resistance from within the military, I would say, compared to what you would expect at the outset of a war when, you know, very few Americans have died when you think about when you think about it. Yes, we've have had a lot killed in terms of, you know, 12 people, more than the Trump administration expected anyway, but that's not like a crisis level number of casualties that would cause, you know, people seeking ways out of this. And so I would say that where we are now is really encouraging and gives me a lot of optimism because if this does continue to escalate, we are kind of already have a good foundation for, you know, continuing to find people in the military who are opposed to it and who want to find ways to fight back.
So obviously your organization focuses on folks who are seeking conscientious objection, but there are also other ways that folks can rebel from inside the military, as you mentioned, the sabotage, also refusing orders if they believe that they're illegal orders. So, plenty of options out there. I was wondering, you mentioned, the lying, and that's pretty standard. Well, for the US in general, but we have heard, that there were just like 12 or 13 members of the military who have died so far. But there was a nurse apparently who has been reporting from the critical care center on the Ramstein base in Germany, which we know that they shifted their care. They're no longer taking women, pregnant women, so that they can use their resources to take care of soldiers. The nurse was saying that they're seeing many more casualties than what we're hearing. Do you have any sense of what the toll is of this?
No, I mean, I tend to trust the casualty numbers. Like it's a lot harder for you know, the US isn't Israel. They have a lot harder, you know, Israel, you can't trust any of the numbers. I think with the US, it's harder for them to really conceal it. I mean, I think they can delay it quite a bit, but you know, I would expect that what we know is, you know, we may be finding out numbers like weeks after they have them. So I think, but I also think that the what we would expect to happen in this war is that the casualties will kind of, even if it stays not as a ground war and it stays like the war that it is, it will continue to develop in the way that it has, right? Where there may be big stretches where nobody is injured or killed, and then you have incidents where many are injured and killed in a single strike, right? I mean, that's just the nature of like the type of munitions that Iran has, that, they can shoot down aircraft, they can land large missiles in areas where people are. And so instead of like a trickle of casualties here and there, people should brace themselves for every so often there's going to be a successful attack that can kill and injure a large number of Americans at one time.
So, before we go, I know that you and your wife, Abby Martin, have produced a few documentaries. The Gaza Fights for Freedom is a very powerful one, if folks have not seen that. So you've spent time in that region, in the military, outside of the military. You just have your current documentary that's touring, Earth's Greatest Enemy, which is about the climate impacts of the U.S. military. Given what's going on most recently, especially with Israel's recent attack on the Pars oil field in Iran, and then Iran's retaliation. After coming off of making this documentary, what are your thoughts about what's happening right now and the impact on the world of this?
Yeah, I mean, I think specifically just being aware of the how long lasting and deadly contaminants are from war, contaminants from munitions alone, let alone the amount of toxins that get released from things like bombing oil fields, the chemical fallout, the cancers, birth defects. I mean, these adverse health effects. I mean, this is going to be an enduring legacy. And I think it's relevant for service members in the sense that I think what they're being told, is, and I got this in an interview I did yesterday on Canadian broadcasting. It was, well, what about the regime, and what about the regime that has killed protesters and, restricts women's rights and all of these things. And, beyond just the direct killing of people with munitions to free a people, as the government says is happening, the crime of just unleashing generational toxins on a massive population. I mean, no one should want to have any part in that. I mean, even if nobody was killed directly from munitions being dropped on Iran, to know that there is just going to be generational cancers and other adverse health impacts from unleashing these kinds of massive numbers of munitions on densely populated cities, it just gives, I think, should give people one more reason to, not want to take part in it.
Absolutely. And then we have a well, two rogue states, the United States and Israel, that are leading this war, and so much of the world is has turned against them, and is there's so many memes out there right now around Trump asking NATO for help and asking European countries and Asian countries for help to open the Strait of Hormuz. Do you have concerns? I mean, we know that the U.S. and Israel attacked Pars, knowing that this was going to escalate things in a very serious way. Israel has nuclear weapons. I think Pakistan is talking to Saudi Arabia about perhaps having an agreement for Saudi Arabia to have access to their nuclear weapons. Do you have concerns about this potentially turning into a nuclear war?
I mean, look, what do we know from? I mean, we're not just talking. The Trump people are insane people. Netanyahu, the government, they're insane people. The Israeli, I mean, Israeli government as a whole and society as a whole is pretty insane. The people in charge of the U.S. right now are just absolutely insane people. So I wouldn't put anything past them. But even looking at not even just the insane individuals that are in charge of both the U.S. and Israel right now, but throughout the entire U.S. history, the modern history of conflict, when a war starts to go badly, when a war blows up in their faces, when a war is exposed to be a total mistake, a total debacle, something that should just immediately be disengaged from to prevent the senseless loss of life and no victory for anyone at the end, history shows us that they never just stop that. They just continue to double down, continue to send more soldiers, increase bombing. I mean, they just dive headfirst into it because politicians don't want to accept a defeat. They don't want to be the one that said, "I lost a war." And so they intensify it and they drag it out and they pass it off to the next military command. They pass it off to the next administration and they let them deal with it. And then those people usually kick the can down the road to the people that follow them, and so on until there's a situation where they have no choice but to end it. And so that's the lessons of the Iraq and Afghanistan and Vietnam wars. And yeah, it's not very encouraging. You know, right now, like, just look at what have they given as the objectives for the Iran war? Like, they don't even really make any sense. Like, right. What are they even trying to accomplish? The reason that they're continuing to escalate this war is because they're mad that Iran has defended themselves. There's really nothing that they're trying to accomplish here. They're just continuing the war for the sake of continuing the war, and that can lead to a very dangerous place. These are not competent or sane people that are calling the shots now.
Right. And I think this is really going to be a world-changing event. Just countries have more and more been kind of more openly acknowledging the fact that the United States is a, you know, a rogue actor, that it forms alliances with countries, but it doesn't really care about those countries at all, and it will turn against them if it serves U.S. interests. Iran is putting that into practice in a very significant way, just saying, you know, we're not even willing to negotiate with you because we've negotiated all these times and you've just lied to us and attacked us anyway. So Iran is not backing down in this. Do you have concerns that this will turn into a broader global conflict? I know that China's assisting with surveillance and, you know, radar detection. Russia's been assisting with providing military equipment. What are your thoughts on where this whole thing is going?
You know, it's true that Iran is going to retaliate to the point that they feel they've made their point to prevent further aggression against them. The thing is Trump people, they could just walk away from this now.
Right.
They could say, you know what? We're pulling all our forces out of there. You can't reach us. You can't hit them. If you want to keep blowing up facilities in Kuwait and Bahrain and stuff like that to teach us a lesson, like, whatever, like, we're out of this, you know? And then things would settle down. Things would settle down. Iran would probably feel shortly after that they have made their point. There's not a reason for them to further escalate. The U.S. is the one that has all the power here to de-escalate. They can tell Israel that they have to de-escalate and pull back, right? People think that Israel has all this control over the U.S. The U.S. could very easily flex its leverage over Israel and get them to stop. That's what could happen. All of this could be brought to a close very soon, regardless of Iran's, you know, desire to make sure that they send a clear message. I think the spiraling situation militarily, but then also the economy, is going to begin getting worse and worse for Americans. That is something that the Trump people can stop right now. If they pull back from this situation right now, this downward spiral of the economy as well will not continue to be a thing. We could very likely be in a situation a month from now where the war has devolved into a lot more violence and death for civilians and for American forces, and that there's a huge amount of discontent in the United States because gas prices are double, food cost is double, and all air travel is double and all of this stuff. And the Trump administration is going to be acting like they had no other choice, but they do have a choice. Right. And I think one of the important things we need to know now is that we're still at a point in the war where we can get them to pull back from it if we are able to build enough pressure. And so they're not going to end this unless they're forced to. And of course, we play a part in that calculation, and people in the military play a part in that calculation too.
Yeah, no, absolutely. People do need to be in the streets right now and making their opposition to this war on Iran very, very vocal. So just let's close with, if you can tell the listeners again, where they can get information and resources if they're questioning their involvement in the military.
Yeah, you can find us on Instagram at Center on Conscience. Our website is centeronconscience.org. We have an X account. It's CCW4COS. We also have an 800 number. It's 800-379-2679, where people can call anytime for a free and confidential and professional advice on what their options are. And so, yeah, I mean, the best way to help us right now is just to help share that information. You know, go to our socials, find the info we're putting out, make sure to share it with people that they may know who have loved ones in the military. You know, of course, donating to us in this moment is huge because we're, like I said, we have 1,000% increase in new clients, and we do not have 1,000% increase in staff. In fact, we have 0% increase in staff. And so, you know, the more we can raise in this moment, the more people we can get helping us out, but also the more we can be getting our message out there more to other people.
Right.
The more soldiers that find us, the more they call us. I mean, we are relatively unknown in the military, the more we become known, the more and more people call us. And so that just tells me there are so many more people out there that we haven't reached that we urgently need to in the coming weeks here.
Yeah, we need to bring back the coffee houses during the Vietnam War and educate more soldiers about what their options are. Well, Mike, thank you so much for the incredible work that you do. And I know you're incredibly busy, so thank you for taking time to speak with me today.
Of course, appreciate you having me.
You've been listening to Clearing the Fog, Speaking Truth to Expose the Forces of Greed. I'm Margaret Flowers. My guests today were James Branham and Mike Preisner. I'll go out with a song by Junkyard Empire. It's called We Want.
Brothers and our sisters, the people together can overthrow the system.